Well, good evening, everybody. I guess that I'd like to do a number of things this evening. One is to share with you things that have preoccupied Josie and myself for nearly 25 years in the truth. It's about 25 years since we began to get involved in Bible mission work, and it's a consuming thing in the lives of those who become involved in it. But more importantly than that, I want to just share with you the way in which God's purpose is being fulfilled. Because the gospel is going to be preached in all the world, and then the end will come. And one of the greatest signs that the return of our Lord is imminent is that that has happened in the last 50 years, but particularly in the last 15 to 20 years, in a remarkable way, wonderful way. The hand of God has been at work. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Bible mission work generally. Then I'm going to just share with you the areas where the CBM out of the UK works. And in particular, just share with you some African stories and a little bit about what life is like in Africa and the things we have to contend with when we go there. And if I can make a terrible pun, and you'll forgive me for it, we have a mission statement. All right? And it isn't just about preaching. You can't just go out and preach to people, baptize them, and leave them. All of the things that we in the Western world take for granted as brethren and sisters about the structure of ecclesial life are completely alien to men and women, not just in third world countries, but in many European countries, particularly behind the Iron Curtain. So with the help of the Lord, the CBM wants to preach the gospel. But then we've got to help our brethren and sisters in ecclesial life through this, who become our brethren and sisters through this preaching. And then, of course, they need our continued support with pastoral care in their new lives. If you live in the sort of poverty that I'm going to share with you in one or two slides, then you will understand why. But perhaps surprisingly, we have always been a missionary body. It isn't just that Brother Thomas worked in the UK and then came across the water to North America. They established Christadelphian communities in the Americas and in Europe and South Africa and Australasia. And some of the stories about how pamphlets were handed out and thrown away as they even are today, and someone came along and picked it up and became baptized, or how a ship's captain came across a copy of Christendom Astray and read it and was baptized and took the gospel into countries there in the Far East. Some wonderful stories about how the truth went around the world, not into every country, but around the world, way back, over 100 years ago. But again, the way the Bible mission was formed about 50 years ago is another remarkable story. And I want to tell you a story about a brother whom you'll know, remember well, and a sister whose name you might not remember. 1904, that August body called the Christadelphian Auxiliary Lecturing Society was formed for the preaching of the gospel in the UK. And it had, as all good Christadelphian bodies have, a committee to run it. And at the end of the Second World War, there were a number of brethren who said, we need to take the gospel into Europe. So there was a campaign in France led by Brother Tom Barling. There was a campaign, I think, in Norway. And the people involved came back and said to this committee, look, there's real interest in preaching the gospel in Europe. And that August body said, no, you can't do that. We've got enough work preaching the gospel in the UK. We're not going to fund any work in Europe. Well, in the mid-50s, there was an ecclesia in Guyana being formed again, interesting way, by a brother from the UK whose work had taken him out there and preached. But it was very small, five brethren and sisters. And Sister Lorraine Spence from Guyana came across to the UK and ended up on a campaign in Dundee in Scotland with Brother Harry Whittaker. Now, there's the name you know. And she was paired up with Brother Harry, and they went around canvassing and knocking on doors, and there was not a lot of interest. And she said to Brother Harry, "Brother Harry, if you came to my country and my ecclesia in Georgetown, I guarantee there'd be greater interest in this." Now, I don't know whether the next bit is apocryphal or not, but the story goes that Brother Harry had to get hold of an atlas to find out where British Guyana was in the top of South America, Guyana today. But as Harry would, Harry said he would go. Harry went, right? Brother Alan Hayward went with him. And the largest wooden building in the world was the town hall in Georgetown in Guyana. And they just stood outside inviting people in. And they had 300 people come in night after night listening to their talks. And the baptisms followed and the ecclesia in Georgetown grew as a result. So Harry came back to the UK and said to this august body of brethren, "We've actually got this sort of response to our preaching in Guyana," and to their eternal credit, the body of brethren said, "This is the Lord's hand at work. We need to change our decision." And the Christadelphian Bible Mission was set up, as it was for very many years, as the overseas branch of the ELS. It became independent finally in 1994. So, right from the beginning, God's hand is at work, and whatever men say, even brethren who have the truth at heart, if it is not God's will in this preaching work, and I'll tell you a little story against myself later on, God directs and God is directing people. Well, where are we today? Not only is there a CBM in the UK, you have a CBM, CBMA, in North America. There is a CBM, Australasian CBM, in New Zealand and Australia. And one of the greatest things, one of the greatest pleasures I've had from being involved in CBM work and in administration of CBM work is that it has brought brethren and sisters together from right across the world, and it has broken down barriers. You know as well as I do, without me going into the details, that we have different styles of ecclesias that tend to work together and separately, each sticking to their own style, and not often do they come together. Well, I tell you that the thing that has broken down barriers, particularly in Australia, I think more than anything else, is brethren finding that they can work together on Bible mission work. And it's the cooperation that's developed and is there today between you in North America and us in the UK and with the Australians and New Zealanders wasn't there 20, 30 years ago, but is there now. One of the things that helped that was that we took the Bible Missionary magazine when we revamped it about 10 years ago and said, "Let's ask the brethren in North America and the brethren in Australasia whether they would like to join in ownership of this magazine." I know they were absolutely taken aback by that. But now if you take this, and this is a strong plug that you take the Bible Missionary magazine, it will tell you of Bible mission work throughout the whole world. So just going back there, we're now between us preaching in well over 70 countries. So all of that's from sort of standing start 50 years ago. The gospel really is going into all the world, over 70 countries, Bible mission work going on. Well, let me just talk for a couple of minutes about preaching in Europe. And if we talk about Western Europe, you can see the shaded countries are the countries where from the UK, we do mission work. It also includes work in the Middle East, which is particularly difficult. We have, for example, people in Iran who learn the gospel. Incredibly difficult to baptize anybody in Iran. You have to do it at the dead of night. You cannot tell anybody about it. If you found out, though, it's a death sentence. It's a death sentence for any Muslim who converts to Christianity. It's against the law with a death sentence to preach Christianity and to try to convert people from Islam to Christianity. So most of the baptisms have taken place in Turkey, and I know that people who have become brethren and sisters of yours and who are Iranian, you Canadians have done a great job in helping them come and resettle, I think, over in Ontario. And that's been wonderful, and that continues, taking people into Turkey to help them in that way. So we've got preaching in the Middle East, and a lot of interest in those countries which have taken Indians from India to do menial work in Arab countries. A lot of interest amongst them. So we've got preaching work in the Middle East, about 20 countries visited, about 400 brethren and sisters. 120 of those are in Western Germany, and particularly the Esslingen Ecclesia, a very strong ecclesia. Elsewhere, it's not a situation where the truth is growing. Most of the brethren and sisters are in isolation. You get into Northern Europe, there's atheism and affluence. People don't want to know. We have very few brethren and sisters. And we have this enormous barrier of Roman Catholicism. If I say that in era where we've been preaching for, 20-odd years, have sent out over 20,000 courses to people. So we've had over 20,000 people who have signed up for a correspondence course, and we've had no baptisms from that at all. The force of Catholicism is incredibly strong. So Western Europe is an extreme example of where the gospel is not going to be accepted. And isn't it interesting, if you look at this here, the things that stop the truth being accepted are the things that we meet in the book of Revelation that the Lord is going to face and overcome at his return. We're in Revelation 17. We're in Revelation 18. We're in affluence and atheism and the apostate church that's there in Revelation 17. Now, I found that really interesting, that this is stopping the truth growing and developing, and these are the things that the Lord is going to fight at his return. East Europe is a different matter, and all of these countries here are the ones where the truth is preached, from Finland in the north to Turkey in the south, over to Kazakhstan, in the Czech Republic, Poland, all the way down here, and from there the truth is actually crossing into North Africa and Morocco, where I think we've got four brethren and sisters now. And the issues are different there. We've got about 20 countries, about 800 brethren and sisters, but only about 15 ecclesias. And most people live in isolation. And there are real problems with that. If you'd lived behind the Iron Curtain, meeting together like this was forbidden. The police would be through the door, would have been arrested. And for, nearly 100 years, 80, 90 years since the Russian Revolution, Christianity was suppressed. People were not allowed to meet to worship together. But more than that, any gathering of people was viewed by the authorities with suspicion. And if I asked you to come and meet with me to learn about the Bible, you were encouraged to report me to the police. So there is this real fear of ecclesial life. Ecclesial life is incredibly strange to Eastern Europeans. They've been taught from childhood not to meet together in bodies like ecclesias. And even if we were all living as brethren and sisters in Victoria, and Victoria was in an Eastern European country, we wouldn't meet together. We'd have great difficulty getting people to meet together in one ecclesia. They don't trust other brethren and sisters. They don't trust each other. They've been brought up that way. So there's a lot of work that has to go on. There are lots of visits, month after month, just short visits, trying to build up ecclesial life, to try and get people to meet together. Real issue with military service, compulsory. If you don't join up, then you are in danger of a very long prison sentence, even facing the death penalty. And I just remind you that it's the Second World War, when in Germany, if you've read Brother Stan Owen's book, Into All the World, there's that moving few pages about the brother, Albert Mertz, who was shot, your brother, who was shot, and the wonderful letter that he wrote the night before his execution. So conscientious objection, your country and mine, might have involved hardship, but it's only in the Second World War that over the Channel in Germany, a brother was shot because he wouldn't fight. And severe hardships there in East European countries for those who will refuse to be called up. You might think you've got a divorce and remarriage problem in your country, or we have in ours. Yeah, we do. But divorce is commonplace in Eastern Europe. Marriage doesn't really mean anything. And so we've got brethren and sisters who come from this culture where divorce, remarriage is a real issue. We had an issue where of a sister from Russia who came across to the UK, married a British brother, settled down. The marriage didn't last. And when she was talked to by the arranging brethren of the ecclesia, she said, "Oh, I think that what God wants for me is he wants me to be happy in life, and I'm not happy in my marriage, so I need to go and find happiness somewhere else." Now, that's not an extreme view. That's the sort of atheist, humanist view that's there in Eastern Europe. So we've got to get across that. There is poverty. There's no health care. There's no extended families in Africa. And there are problems with language and problems with large distances and problems with Islamic intolerance, particularly in the south. If you just look there at Kazakhstan, the brother who from the UK who looks after Kazakhstan is Brother David Pierce. Well, I think about 5 years ago, he held a Bible school in Kazakhstan, and the authorities burst through the doors. They're arrested. They're taken off to prison. They haven't got authority to have a Bible school. Everybody's name's taken. And they are banned from going back. So we're actually trying to preach the truth in Kazakhstan. But British people, the CBM team, is banned from going there. David can't get there. So there's some real issues in countries which are Islamic, and where there have been totalitarian countries, and very difficult to overcome. But let me just share this with you before we leave Eastern Europe. There was this wonderful opportunity to get into these countries in 1985, 1982, after the fall of the Iron Curtain and the breakup of the USSR. And I wouldn't say that that is closing, but it is certainly true that the interest in the gospel in Eastern Europe is declining. We had baptisms in the Czech Republic. Czech Republic has adapted very well to being westernized, has learnt many lessons from Western Germany. It's sort of a younger model of Western Germany, affluent, well cared for country. No longer any interest. Brethren and sisters falling away in the Czech Republic. Now, I don't know what you make of that, but I think we have had a window of opportunity to go and preach the gospel And the very fact that the interest in it in some of these countries, has declined, suggests to me that the return of the Lord must be very near. The gospel has gone throughout the whole world. And perhaps the Lord is reaching the point where the number he's going to call has been made up. There are still countries where there's interest. Four members in 1997, 200 today in Russia. So there's a balance there. But overall, we are seeing a decline in the number of men and women who are coming to the gospel. What about Africa? Well, there's West Africa. Split it into two, West Africa and East Africa. Those are the countries we preach in. Preach in Chad, you can't get into Chad. So brethren from Cameroon there, get into Chad. There's no such thing as a guest house or a hotel or a lodging place in Chad. It's really like Old Testament times. You go into a town and you need someone to offer you hospitality. Real police state, even the Cameroon people find it difficult getting in there and preaching there. Closed country. Nigeria, the most corrupt country in the world. Cameroon, number two. Roadblock after roadblock with the police who, as soon as they see the white man, want money to let you go on. Tremendous problems in Nigeria between the Muslims in the north, the Christians in the south. I don't know whether you get it in your papers, but there's been fighting, massacres again up here, places where we go when the brethren go to preach in Nigeria. Talking to a brother who'd been to Nigeria once, and he was telling me they got it one day and were about to go down the river to visit a settlement where they'd got students some miles down the river, and were told, don't go today, the headhunters are in that area. Now, by the headhunters, they don't mean people who've come to see, would you like to come and work for a company, you know, I'll get you a better job. They meant the people who'd like to take your head off. And that's still there in some of these remote areas up in the north of Nigeria. So, 1957, first baptism was in Nigeria. Ecclesias established in Nigeria and Ghana, three brethren in Cameroon. Today, over 2,000 brethren and sisters, 70 ecclesias, 13 countries. And I hope it doesn't sound just trite to say whom the Lord will. It really is God at work in this. But we had real benefits from long-term missionaries there in the 1970s and committed correspondence work. And in places like Liberia and Sierra Leone, where the terrible, terrible problems of persecution and people fleeing and brethren taking the gospel with them wherever they went. So West Africa, a place where there was nobody who knew the gospel, and now over 2,000 brethren and sisters. And that's the other side of Africa. So we are working from Ethiopia in the north all the way down to Zimbabwe in the south, even working Swaziland there and working with the South Africans in this area, and also in southern Mozambique. No interest in Botswana, and although we've tried, no interest in Namibia. Angola, we've got students there, but you cannot get into the country without an invitation, and there's nobody to invite us in. And some very interesting stories about work in East Africa. For example, Josie and I have been to Ethiopia, and another little story about that in a minute. But I guess 15 years, 10 years, something like that. No interest. People who would come. And there were voices in the CBM, and I would be one of them, who was saying, well, you know, we've been here, the scriptural principle, let it alone this year. Lord, 3 years we've dunged and tended the tree, and there's no fruit from it. Let it alone this year, says the Lord. Not speaking about his death after 3.5 years. And then suddenly, after 10 years, something like that, baptisms begin to come. And it's a great credit to the brother and sister who's managed that work, looked after that work, that they persevered. And so mission work is a great message about the need for patience. I realised as I was sat waiting for the meeting to start that figure's wrong. It's actually over 15,000. So that's more brethren and sisters in East Africa than there are in North America and Australasia and the UK combined. There's once at a meeting at the Christadelphian office, you know, just sharing this with the editor, Brother Michael Ashton, saying, more brethren and sisters in Malawi, Michael, than there are in the UK. Perhaps we ought to shift the office to Africa. And I have to say that he wasn't well pleased with that. I got a rather frosty look. I know Michael very well, but I just didn't register with him there. Another story. This is a story about myself. In 1994, Brother David Nightingale asked me to go to Malawi. That was the first time I went to Africa. And I'd just gone on CBM Council, just become chairman of CBM. And we were desperately short of money. And I said to Council, we really cannot afford to go into any new countries. We've got to concentrate where we are now working. Well, there'd been this terrible civil war in Mozambique, and it became a closed country, really, for a while. Civil war ended. David and I are in a vehicle going to a village one day in Malawi. We get lost. We're in the bush. We have to send one of the two brethren with us to a village to find the directions, chatting to George, the other brother with us. And he suddenly says, we've got over 100 brethren and sisters in Mozambique now. So I said, what do you mean we've got over 100 brethren and sisters in Mozambique? Oh, yeah, we've been across the border, because the Malawian borders with Mozambique, they speak the same language. The war's over, so they've gone across, they've taken the gospel. So, you know, I'm left thinking, but I said we shouldn't go and preach the gospel in new countries. Brethren and sisters, we've got over 5,000 brethren and sisters in Mozambique now, from none 10, 15 years ago. And I sort of hang my head in shame before you, and acknowledge, as I've tried to in the past, the utter stupidity of trying to say we shouldn't go into any new countries. God decides. God literally, physically, absolutely decides whom he's going to call and where he wants his word preached. And he decided that there were many men and women in Mozambique whom he wanted. So we've got over 3,000 people taking the correspondence course. Over 10% of brethren and sisters in the UK are directly involved in mission work. So that's about 1,000 brethren and sisters overall. A bit less than that, not a lot. And it's the greatest percentage of any body. So if you look at ALS, if you look at preaching in the UK, you look at Meal a Day, none of them have as many brethren and sisters involved as the CBM does. And the reason is that we have so many brethren and sisters who are helping with correspondence. And so we've got this great groundswell of support. But we've got problems, ethnic violence and civil war. 60% of all of the people in East Africa exist on less than $1 a day. All right? So if the challenge was for you for the next 12 months to exist on $365, now you've got, is it the loonie you call it? Parity with the greenback? Because that's the dollar that's used in these calculations. You know, they exist on less than a dollar a day. You think what poverty is. Well, that's it. I'm going to show you some pictures in a minute. Just let me talk about the problems. Language, Bibles, money, welfare, village life, sexual morality. I have enough trouble with Canadian English. But when you come to Africa, words mean quite different things. So if I want to register that the brother I'm referring to is a Zambian brother, I would call him a local brother. No, don't do that. Local means something that is weak and unimportant. So you say, well, what should I call him? Call him a black brother. Right? Now, yeah, okay, we'd now laugh at that because that's not something we want to do, is it? That's now making a distinction between black and white that we're a bit uncomfortable with, should be uncomfortable with, are taught to be uncomfortable with in our society. But as brethren and sisters together, we don't want to make that distinction. They don't want anything that's popular, because popular means it's very common. Right? So if you give them a Bible and you say, for example, oh, this is a very popular Bible. I'll have something that's not popular, please, because I'm just going to be the same as everybody else. Love always is sexual, without hesitation, without exception. Love relates to man and woman. Love in their language, in their culture, is always about sex. And sex is a huge problem. Problems of AIDS, come on to that. So just teaching people about agape, about the love of the New Testament, is very difficult. Right? Homosexuality is absolutely abhorred in Africa. They will not tolerate it at all. So to teach them about the love that brethren can have for each other and the beauty of it, at times is quite difficult. Can I help you? Right? You see someone in trouble and you say, you know, Jerome, can I help you? Jerome's an African brother. Jerome's going to think he's going to give me some money. Right? That's what it means. And when any African brother comes and says, Brother Andrew, I've got a problem, you always know what it is. It is always about money. In fact, they have the most absolutely infuriating way of tackling this. It's as if they know that these things are going to irritate you and frustrate you, and so you might be with them a week, and on the last day you say to Josie, hasn't it gone really well here this week? And you're getting in the vehicle to leave, and just as you're about to drive off, someone will come up to you and say, there might be a queue of them waiting to see you. Brother Andrew, got a problem. At the last moment, when you could have sorted all the issues out in the week, they'll come and say to you, got a problem. Can you help me? Oh. Right. Interesting thing about Bible. Where am I going with this? Yeah, still on with language. You can never use the word stupid. Stupid, they're very sensitive to criticism from white people. Stupid means very rude and offensive. A couple of years ago, Josie and I were in Zambia. And we'd been along a very good road with a local brother to see some students. And we'd not had much success, so we had time on our hands. And as we're coming back, he told us that his wife and children had gone to see her parents. She hadn't been very well, so she'd gone back to her parents, and it's just off in the bush. So I said, have we got time? Would you like us to divert and go? Oh, yes, please. So we go off into the bush, and we drive, and we drive, and we drive, and we're driving on the edge of the Kalahari, and it gets sandier and sandier and more difficult to drive, and we're in a pickup truck. We finally get stuck in the sand, and I explode, and they're very upset. We'd gone 90 kilometres off the road, but it's not very far. And I had to apologise to them because they were so upset at my being cross. They couldn't understand why I was cross. You know, it was nearly night time, stuck in the sand, 90 kilometres off the road, got to get back. We never did see his wife and get kids there. Would you like a cup of tea? No, thank you. You know exactly what I mean. I'm politely declining your offer of a cup of tea. You say no thank you to an African. There, you can see the bewilderment on their face. Because no is negative and thank you is positive. It's as if you were saying, no, yes. Do you want one or don't you want one? Now, that can make them seem very rude, because if you serve food to them, if you're at Bible camp, for example, and you're helping to serve food to them, would you like some more shema? No. Okay, you've been muttering away. Could at least say thank you. I think if it's one of your kids, you'd have made them say thank you, wouldn't you? But that's just the way they are. They don't think of saying thank you. Thank you means yes. So, no. Brother Andrew, I've got a problem. Oh, I suggest you go and see Sister Josie. They see that as I order you to see. And they will then take that and use that and say to the rest of the brethren and sisters in the ecclesia, oh, Brother Andrew has told me I must go and see Sister Josie about this. And then the whole thing sort of spirals out of hand. And you say, no, I only suggested. You don't have to if you don't want to. You decide what you want to do. That was just a suggestion. Bible's a currency. And this is a real issue that in sending Bibles to students, sometimes the house is burnt down, it's been stolen, the dog ate it, I lost it on the bus. We never give a second Bible because Bibles get sold. And we have this wonderful situation where when we first went to Ethiopia, the sister who had written the letter to this group of students began the invitations, dear so-and-so, thank you for your interest in the Bible. Now you know exactly what that means. Thank you for your interest in the Bible message. But there they are, they all turned up expecting to be given a Bible because we had said, thank you for your interest in the Bible. Great, I'll go. These people are going to bring me a Bible. So you've got to be ever so careful about what you do. And every white man is rich. By definition, if you are white, you are rich. And Africans think differently about money to Western people. So, I'm sorry, Jerome, but you're the president and you're on the front row, so you are in my little role play. Okay. So you come to me and say, Brother Andrew, I've got a problem. So I know you're after some money. And you say to me, I owe $100 and I've got to pay it by next month. So I explore this debt with you and decide that this is a reasonable problem for me to help with you. So I put my hand in my pocket and give you $100 for the problem and say to you, Jerome, you really got to make sure that on the 1st of April you pay this money, otherwise you're going to be in a bigger problem. Yes, Brother Andrew. Okay, say yes, Brother Andrew. Right, you understand. Okay, tomorrow your wife's cousin's second removed with all of their seven kids, comes knocking on your door because he's lost his house and he has nowhere to live. And because he's your family, you've got to help him. You never ever turn family away. How are you going to help him? Oh, Brother Andrew gave me some money. Right? So you use that money to help today's problem. Today's problem. And when next month comes, and you haven't got the money to pay the man, you have to go back to Brother Andrew and explain. And at first you think they are dishonest, and they're not dishonest. It is a different way of thinking about money and resources. They cannot plan. That's not a criticism of them. This is the way they have lived for centuries, and therefore we need to give the help in a way that tries to prevent this. Try and find ways to, you know, if you've got a debt, well, take me to the man and we'll pay it together. That sort of thing, whatever. And welfare can corrupt as well as help. We've got, I'm not trying to boast about this, but the CBM's got 50 years of experience in this. And we still make mistakes. We still get caught out. Josie and I just got caught out at the moment. A big project in Zambia where the Meal a Day Fund is funding some school buildings. And I raised the project. I got it absolutely defined by my brethren in Zambia how much they wanted. And of course, it's now not enough. So the thing's snowballing. No project is ever delivered to budget in Africa. Never. It's always more money. And I'll say it. I hope this isn't too political. Just get a little bit nervous about agape in action, understanding this. Yeah. I know how much it means to you. But there's a way of working in Africa that does not corrupt people with welfare. Examples. We've got in Zambia over 100 people who are prisoners who take the Bible course. We had one who was released from prison, wanted to be baptized. He was baptized. Asked for help for resettlement. So the white brother from the UK who's dealing with him gave him, if I say 1.5 million kwacha, that sounds a huge amount. But it's about 500 of your dollars. So he's got this money, and that's enough to resettle him, help him to start a little business, help him to build his life. And his family heard he had been given money, and they all came round that night, and he hands it all out, right? And they all go and spend it on beer, and within a week it's all gone. And it was another Zambian brother who told me how this affects them. So the brother who's been given the money is now very ashamed of what he's done. And so rather than come and say to me or to his ecclesia or to any visiting missionary brother, I've made this big mistake, he leaves the truth. Right? So he doesn't want to meet Brother Andrew, in case Brother Andrew is a bit cross with him because of what he's done. And welfare like this can lead people away from the truth. Even helping them to get a better life. Josie and I helped a young man in Zambia to go on, is it plumbing course? Plumbing course, just to learn to be a plumber. Got a job at the end of it. Got a better job at the end of it. He was a plumber working in the police station, so he's linked to the police. He got a better job working as a traffic officer, civilian job, but linked with the police. Left the truth. Just now sees that he's got what he wants from life, which is material things. So welfare is incredibly difficult to give, and sometimes welfare in kind is better than money. It's a family there in Zambia, grandmother and extended family. Grandparents often end up looking after grandchildren because of premature death. Average lifespan in Zambia is 42, lowest in the world. But that's where they live, in this here. It actually was a sort of a cow shed, their home, which wasn't much better than that, burnt down. But that is pretty typical of village life in Africa. Or here are three brethren. I don't know. Which one's Herod, Joe?
Middle
one. Okay. It's a brother called Herod, right? I'll tell you, we've got another brother called Agrippa. We had a brother called Evil, right? And when he was baptized, he changed his name to Good. They call themselves anything. I was asking a Zambian brother about this. He said, oh, Brother Andrew, he said, it's very easy. Anything that the white man does, they think is wonderful in the villages. He was very scathing of his own kind. He said, the white man gives them a ride in his pickup truck, and they think, what a great vehicle this is. What a great gearbox this vehicle has. He goes back to his village, and his wife has a baby, and he says, I'll call him Gearbox. And they do. They're the most incredible names that we have. But this is Herod. But this brother is Kenneth, and this is Augustine. Is that right? Joe got it the right way around. Terribly sad. He lived in the city of Livingston, and they came one day and said to me, Brother Andrew, we are starving. Can you help? And you go to their homes, and they have no food, and they're thin, and they live in an area that's absolutely rife with TB. and you can tell they've got TB. And all you can do is go and buy some food and leave it. We spent every last kwacha we had buying food for them. And within 12 months, they're dead. And that's one of the sad things about going to Africa, is that you meet people who you know, brethren and sisters, who you know you're not going to see again. There was a young brother who had AIDS. And it actually brought him back to the truth. He'd been out of fellowship for right reasons, behavioural issues. And he understood that he was going to die, and persuaded his ecclesia to take him back. And my final meeting with him was, we were talking to each other, and I said, "You know I'm not going to see you again." And he nods. And I said, "The only thing that for you to do is now is to be faithful in your belief and stick to it this time." So life's full of tragedy. People die young. Infant mortality is about 10 times what it is in the UK. And village life is an incredible problem to being in the truth. It's tribal based, and racism between tribes is far worse than black-white racism. It's very close-knit and superstitious, really. So if your relative dies in a hut, nobody will live in that hut again. The hut is destroyed because of the spirits. The witch doctor, the Ngambi man, is still a very strong influence. Once in Cameroon, and they took me indoors, and they wouldn't let me out in the village because the witch doctor was coming into town to choose a new quarter chief, and I hadn't got to be around. And this guy comes prancing down the village street, you know, in all his regalia, and they really believe in this guy. But most of all, it provides a welfare state. Now, I can tell you this, brethren and sisters, when the end comes and Christ returns, certainly in the UK, our society will fall apart because we're all so selfish. It is third world countries that will face it better because the family looks after itself, the village looks after itself. But if you are baptized and you then don't take part in the village, then you are sort of an outcast. Last year we were there, went to see a terribly poor brother and sister, awfully poor. And said, "Well, why doesn't the village help?" Well, the village meetings are held on Sundays, and he won't go to these meetings on Sundays, and so the village won't help him. You know, he needs help to dig his field. The village doesn't offer that help. So we get brethren and sisters, we baptise them in villages, and we've got to provide an alternative to the village system. And I haven't got many photos, but there, that's absolutely typical situation. Preaching, talking about the gospel to a group of people out in the bush. That's where they live, that's their background. Life is like that, living out in the bush. And AIDS is a terrible, terrible problem. South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, which is only 1.7 million people, is in danger of being wiped out by AIDS. Talking to Brother Anthony Oosthuizen about this 10 years ago, and he said, South Africa, 40 million people, 5 million white, 35 million black. He said, the white Afrikaners now are understand that if AIDS goes unchecked, it will do for them what apartheid couldn't do. Because the forecast, and I don't know if this is still true, I found it incredible, but you know, Anthony being Anthony, you believe it, is that it will reduce the ratio from 1 to 7 or to about 1 to 2. So if there's 5 million white people, there'll be 10 million black South Africans. The death rate in South Africa amongst teachers from AIDS is such that they need a teacher training college of nearly 2,000 students just to keep the numbers up. So it isn't just that it kills people, it's got an incredible effect on societies that are trying to improve themselves, professional people. And one person becomes HIV positive every 25 seconds in Africa. So it's an appalling problem there. And that's why the life expectancy in Zambia went down from being in the 50s down to, it went as low as 39. I think it's back up to 42. So HIV, AIDS, and it's there in the ecclesias. It's no use shutting brethren and sisters, you know. We don't have little cups like you do. We have the cup. And you know when you go to Africa, you're going to share bread and wine somewhere with a brother or sister who's HIV positive. Just got to get on and do it, which we do. But it's an awful problem, and it brings terrible disease. I've seen people in a terrible mess from it. I'm going to end on a positive note, but just to one slide on CBM correspondence. I've mentioned this, so I needn't go through it. Really is the engine of our CBM work is the correspondence work. And more than 3,000 contacts, and 25 teams, and 1,000 brethren and sisters from 200 ecclesias involved in this. But let me just talk to you about what I call the joy of baptism and one or two stories. Don't know whether you've ever heard of the Blind and Handicapped Centre in Bengui in Cameroon. You can just see there the sticks of the people, students who live there who are witnessing this baptism. This is Brother Charles and Ken McKen, the great friend of mine, my best friend in Africa, who had a kidney problem, went into hospital. They operated, they messed him around so much he came out and he died. But he was a lovely man, and being in the army, left the army because he wanted to be baptized. Because he left, they refused to pay his pension, so he gave everything up to be a Christadelphian. Was the principal of the blind and handicapped school, built this little baptismal pool. It's lovely, isn't it? He is a young man being baptized, clean water, lovely surroundings, people stood around. You could associate with that as a baptism. But mostly they're in rivers, like this. My memory of this is that they said the water was very cold, but it's a beautifully clean mountain stream. And here they are, these two brethren, going to baptize this young man. And again, you could be stood there and think, this is lovely. This is just how baptism should be. Or that's our brother Emmanuel Watchon Cum, another river. Right at the bottom of a ravine, real trek down to it, but again, beautiful water, lovely surroundings, taught many people the truth. Interesting man. He's a very educated man. Cameroon's bilingual, French and English, and he went to Paris to take a degree in French. And before he was baptized, because he is such a competent man, the government got hold of him and drew him into government affairs. He became a chef d'affaires, I think it was. He led 3 diplomatic missions for the government. And he was the vice principal of a high school of 1,600 kids. And he got baptized. They wanted him to become the local mayor or the local MP. When he became baptized, he said, I am not going to have anything to do with politics again. And he told me some of the corruption and the way he could have become very rich through it. And so they said to him, if you don't do it, when the election comes, if you don't work for us, you will lose your job and we'll knock you down to being an ordinary teacher. He was very phlegmatic about it. Fortunately, they haven't done it. Tell you one of my favourite stories about baptisms. Took Brother Michael Ashton to Cameroon once for a couple of weeks. And I always like the local brethren to do the baptisms because the person baptized is going to belong to their ecclesia. So I have to teach them what to say. I have to teach them 2 hands like this, put your hand on their hand behind the neck, down into the water and out again. Well, Michael stood over here on a little bridge. I'm stood down here on the bank, and 2 brethren and the man to be baptized are in the water. Yeah, go through the words. Okay. And they get it all wrong, and they take their hands off his, and arms and legs go all over the place. So I said, no, stop, don't come out. You've got to do it again. Remember what I told you. Two hands there, hand over, into the water, and out again. Good. Right, Brother Andrew. Two hands there, hand over there. Put the man into the water. And they stopped. And they're looking at me. I said, all right. Yeah. And the man's held under the water. Now, I tell you, it seemed like eternity. Now, the phrase, dying with Christ, took on a real new meaning. It can't have been more than 1 or 2 seconds. It really can't. And Michael stood over here going, laughing his head off. So I'm saying, get him out. I've got time for another Michael Ashton story in Cameroon. Some of you might have heard this from him. We're in a village, a very remote village, very, very remote, primitive village. And there's a new ecclesia at the bottom of the mountain, and 2,000 feet up is the main ecclesia. Sunday comes, said to Mike, you go up with the brethren there. I need to go to the new ecclesia. So off he goes. I meet him in the village square at the end of the day, as arranged. Now I'm taking some photos, and Mike comes. I said, how'd it go? He said, okay, well, the vehicle broke down, and we had to walk up, and it's a real slog. He said, but we went round this bend, walking up the hill, and a naked woman's walking down the track towards us. And the brethren said, oh, take no notice of her. Take no notice of her, Brother Michael. She's mad. So she passed and walked down to the village, and he's talking to me about it. Now I'm going right in the center. And he said, and here she comes now. So I turn on my camera, and there is this naked woman just, you know, coming up behind me. So camera goes away as quick as I can put it, and Michael's bursting himself laughing at this. And we go home, and I think, I don't need to bother telling Josie about the naked woman story. But the next time she met Jane, Sister Jane, Michael's wife, Jane said, did Andrew tell you about the naked woman in Cameroon? So Michael had talked about it. So things you don't meet in Victoria. All right. And very quickly, let me just finish this. Now, this isn't quite so nice, is it? That this man, Lawrence is his name. Just remembered it. This man who is being baptized, there, that's him, is absolutely, totally crippled. So he's been manhandled down this bank. What you can't see is a very large herd of cows here who use this poo. So that this isn't nice water at all. So in a very rough and ready way, he's been sort of slid down this extremely muddy bank. And they've got to hold him and baptise him and then get him back up the bank. There's nothing dignified about this at all. I lived about a year afterwards and fell asleep. This is yours truly here, and a brother Peter Osborne from Australia, in this horrible cow pond here. There's all sorts of muck and filth and things in the water. And this is an 80-year-old man we're baptising. That's the only water that's available. My memory of that is I was wearing flip-flops. I would never, ever go barefoot into water in Africa. And they kept floating off. But much to Peter's intense irritation, I'm not used to wearing flip-flop. This is in Uganda. That's another baptism. And it looks okay, doesn't it? Here's all the ecclesia. Me taking the photo from the bridge over in this river. Except along here are the cows again, which are doing what cows do when they come to the water. We are baptising. Along here are women washing the clothes in the river, and somewhere, and I can't remember which side, are people gathering the drinking water for the village. So that's multi-purpose, this. Or how about this? There is a tiny little rivulet, can you see, coming down the mountainside. It's the only water for a few miles around, just this tiny little dribble. So they've put this little dam here, this little weir. But you can see how little water there is. So this is Brother Ian Fifield. There's a man under there, and they're trying to baptise him. And they're they did it, but poor bloke, be under there. There's a man pushing him here, a man pushing him there, a man, look at it, physically pushing him down into the water to be baptised. And we're baptised in some odd places. Baptised in in ponds where the Zambians wouldn't go in. They're so mucky. So, you know, we've got to baptize people. We've got to go in. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. I didn't intend to go on so long. But I hope I've given you a flavor of it. But please do remember this, this wonderful opportunity in the last 50 years to take the gospel to men and women who would never otherwise have heard it. And so many thousands have responded, and yet now it's beginning to dry up. It's drying up in Africa, drying up in Zambia. Still interest, but it's not growing. Drying up in countries throughout the world. And what we need to remember, brethren and sisters, is that we need your prayers. Your CPM needs your prayers, the brethren who work. We need the blessing of Almighty God. And the thing that mission work does more than anything else is remind us that what we do is his work and not ours.